looks like it's time. It's 8:30. You probably all want to get to bed at a reasonable hour, so I'll get started. My name is Elsa Marty. I am going to be talking about interfaith relations tonight. The whole this week, I'll be talking about India and religion and interfaith relations in India. But tonight, I'm just talking generally about interfaith relations. And I recognize that there's a lot of diversity of experience in this room. Like, for example, who knows what all of these symbols, what religions they each represent? Anybody can name all of them? Oh, let's try that. Let's work as a group. What's this?
Shinto.
Shinto.
Jainism. Yin Yang. Yep, that's Wiccan. Up at the top there, the nine-pointed star.
Baha'i.
The swastika. Yeah, it's Indian religions, Hindu or Jain. Up at the top. Yep. Mm-hmm. That circle there.
Zen.
Mm-hmm. It's a Zen circle.
Om,
Hinduism.
Jewish,
David, the cross. Sakanda, it's for the Sikh religion.
Sikhs.
And that's a wheel of Dharma from Buddhism. So, all right. So we'll start with a quote from Dr. Hans Kung. There will be no peace among the nations without peace among the religions. There will be no peace among the religions without dialogue among the religions. So that's why we're here, to talk about this. Quick word on my background. Raised Lutheran, came here a lot, had a lot of friends from other religions, active in politics, social justice, and environmental issues. I went to St. Olaf College, where I studied abroad on the global semester program, where we went to a lot of different countries. And India was by far my favorite because there was so much religious diversity there. So I came back and started studying interfaith relations more, started a student group, got my degree in religion. After that, I spent some time over the summer at an interfaith academy. There were about 20 or 30 of us at this intensive retreat in Kansas City. It was really great. And then I went to India for a year and I studied interfaith relations there. I had an internship with a human rights organization in India. And then I went to the University of Chicago Divinity School, where I currently am a Master of Divinity student. That's preparation for pastoral ministry and also for further academic work. And last summer I was back in India studying about the situation of Christians in India. So that's my experience with interfaith relations. But I think it would be good to ask a little bit about what you think interfaith relations is and what sort of experience you've had. So I ask that you turn to your neighbor briefly and just briefly share, what sort of experience have you had with interfaith relations? What does that term mean for you? And what sorts of questions or concerns do you have about what that might mean? What do you think its purpose is? So I'll give you 2 minutes. How's that sound? 2 minutes each. We'll go for 4 minutes. Okay. All right. I hope this conversation can continue afterward. Interfaith relations is all about sharing stories and hearing one another's stories. So please, please continue these conversations later. But right now, I'm interested in, do people have questions? Do people have concerns? Do people have things, brief things that they want to share quickly? We have a few minutes for sharing here, for questions. Concerns? Yes.
What's a basic primer that you could find out a little bit about all of those various things? You might have all of that in a text or a book or something a person could pick up.
On interfaith relations or on different religions?
The various religions. You have a little
succinct. The ELCA has the this wonderful resource, which is in the library here at Holden. And it's really fantastic. I use this with my youth group at church, high schoolers, and it was just fantastic. So it covers a bunch of different religions, not all of them, a bunch of different Christian denominations. A lot of the kids have no idea what the difference is between a Presbyterian and a Lutheran. A lot of us might not even know. So this is really, really a useful book.
What's the title on it?
Honoring Our Neighbor's Faith.
Is it in print anymore?
It is in, I believe it's still in print. It's published by Augsburg Fortress, 1999. But I'll have this up here afterward if you want to write down the title or anything. Are there any other comments or?
Well, yes. Just our conversation was we all agree that a dialogue is good, but mm-hmm. we don't know what dialogue methods are available and have been working right. That's the question.
Great. Excellent segue. All right. Well, before we get to those methods, I first want to talk a little bit about theology of religions. Because a lot of people have questions about this. As you start talking to people of other faiths, you start thinking, okay, well, what does my faith tell me about what that person believes? Is what they believe valid? How does it fit into my religious beliefs? So just like we have a theology of creation, a theology of salvation, we can also talk about a theology of religions. A typical categorization has three different umbrellas that you might fall underneath: exclusivism, inclusivism, and pluralism. So that nice Latin phrase, extra ecclesiam nulla salus, means outside of the church there is no salvation. So exclusivism is exactly what it sounds like. From a Christian exclusivist would say, only through faith in Jesus Christ are you saved. Or something like that. And it's important to recall that people of all religions have this sort of reflection about other religions. So you can have a Hindu who's an exclusivist. It's only through Ram that we're saved. It's only through, well, saved, then we have to talk about what does that mean. Or a Muslim who says, no, it's only through Allah. If you worship another God beside Allah, like Jesus, no salvation. Carl Sandburg, the poet, said that the ugliest word in the English language is exclusive. And it is not a pretty term and not a category into which most people would want to name themselves, I think. But there's a lot of validity there too. So we shouldn't dismiss people out of hand who are theologically exclusivists. Inclusivism is basically, you know, well, there are good things in your tradition. Ultimately, it's through my tradition that everybody is saved. So Karl Rahner talked about anonymous Christians. You know, they don't know Christ, but it's Christ who saves them. All grace is Christ's grace. And pluralism. Two different schools of thought within pluralism. The first that we might be more familiar with is that there are many paths, but only one mountain. All religions lead to the same truth. The philosopher John Hick talks about the real, and all our religions are just different ways of, different languages of talking about the real. A newer movement is to say that, well, there are many paths, and they all lead up different mountains. So different religions diagnose the human condition differently, and they propose different solutions. So is the solution to lose yourself in nirvana? Is it to overcome sin? What are we aiming at? And some pluralists would say we're aiming at very different things, and these different paths are leading to different things. Theologian Paul Nitter, I have This is a good, helpful introduction, Introducing Theologies of Religions. Talks about four different models. So instead of using the term exclusivism, he uses the term the replacement model. So, you know, your religion needs to be replaced by mine. The fulfillment model for inclusivism. Your religion has good things in it, but ultimately it's fulfilled through my religion. The many paths, one mountain. The mutuality model. We're all talking about the same thing. Or many paths, many mountains. An acceptance model. You know, it's just, they're just very different cultural linguistic frameworks, and you have to be in one in order to understand it, or in this one to understand it, and they can't quite talk to each other. You just accept that they're very different. So those are four different models, and people propose other alternatives because often they're not happy in any one of these. But what I want to stress is that you don't have to believe any particular theology of religions in order to have relationships with people of other faiths. It's if you can still respect that person and allow them their autonomy, their dignity, you can have a relationship with them. So I think I personally would probably fall in this inclusivist category. But in this room, we probably have people who would identify with all four of these different models and others. So move on to the next slide. So a word about terms. Is there a difference? Interfaith, interreligious, multi-faith, multi-religious? And how does this relate to ecumenical, intra-faith? So people usually use the terms interfaith and interreligious interchangeably. I think that there may be a shift toward interfaith because people see it as broader than interreligious. So I may be spiritual but not religious, and then I can fall under interfaith because I don't want a religion because that's institutional. But I could participate in interfaith because we all have faith. I think that's probably the rationale behind that movement toward interfaith rather than interreligious. Multi-faith would usually describe an event or something that has people of various faiths there, or it might describe somebody who practices multiple faiths. Ecumenical, we usually use that to talk about within a faith. So within Christianity, ecumenical relations is denominational, interfaith relations between different faiths, different religions. Intra-faith, intra just means within, so the same sort of thing as ecumenical, within a faith conversations. And interfaith conversations usually lead to intra-faith conversations. You realize that you need to figure out what exactly does my faith believe, and then you have conversations with other people of your faith, and you realize there's a lot of diversity there, a lot of things to work through. Now, some people are starting to use interfaith in a new sort of way, which is more syncretic, synchronistic mixing of faith. So there are these interfaith seminaries where people would go to become leaders of that sort of all religions are one. I will lead you in a Hindu prayer now. Next, a Jewish prayer, and they're all the same thing. So there is a growing phenomenon of these interfaith ministers who believe that all religions are the same. And the term religious cooperation is a term used by Eboo Patel, who runs the Interfaith Youth Corps out of Chicago. Generally a good thing that we could agree upon, I think. So some practical things. Forms of dialogue. Usually there's a fourfold distinction, but a lot of people would add a fifth. So the dialogue of life, the daily informal interactions that you have with people in your workplace, on the bus, your neighbors, about, you don't need to talk about your religion, but you just, you have a relationship with them, and you just talk about what goes on in your lives. Other things might be interfaith marriages, caring, offering pastoral care, a chaplain in a hospital. You have these interactions, these encounters with people of other faiths, and that's just part of the dialogue of daily life. The dialogue of action, people of different religions come together around a common concern. Maybe they do service projects together, or else they do advocacy work, like organizations like Interfaith Power and Light, or the National Interfaith Alliance Against Torture, sorts of things. Jewish Muslim student coalitions that are working together to push for kosher and halal kitchens at their colleges. The dialogue of theologies is what people often think about when they hear interfaith dialogue. They think about conferences, seminars, you know, sort of debates between people of different religions. This is talking about, you know, what do you believe? Sitting down and saying, okay, today we're going to talk about the afterlife. Today we're going to talk about what happens after you die. Or next week we're going to talk about human nature. What does your religion say about human nature? These sorts of things. That's really valuable. There's it's very important for us to reflect upon our beliefs and learn more about what others believe. But it's only one among many kinds of dialogues. The dialogue of contemplation and devotion, or religious experience. This might involve sharing a spiritual observance together and learning from it. So you could go to a mosque and watch people do their prayers on Fridays, or have an interreligious prayer together. And there are lots of questions about what's happening in that space. If people of different religions come together and offer a communal prayer, what's happening? What is that? There's lots of space to reflect upon that. Or maybe going to a Hindu temple and doing puja, where you offer some flowers or something to one of the gods. And different people have different opinions about whether or not they think that's okay. Is it okay that I believe Jesus Christ is my Lord and Savior? Is it okay for me to go and offer flowers to a stone statue? There are lots of people who would say it's not okay. There are lots of people who would say, well, it depends what you think it means. So that leads to a lot of conversations. You have to be a little bit sensitive with this, because there are some people who just, it's forbidden by their religion to participate in another sort of ceremony. So maybe you just want to sit in the back and watch it. That feels a lot more comfortable. There are also a lot of people who don't want you to participate if you don't believe it. So, like, we say, you know, don't come to the communion table unless you've been baptized, unless you believe that Christ has died for your sins. And, you know, and we open our communion table to all baptized Christians, but do we open it even further than that, you know? Like, or do we want people to come in, and if they participate in this ritual with us, to be on the same page as us? So you have to be really sensitive when engaging in other people's religious practices. Taking prayers from other traditions, is this a form of religious plagiarism? I mean, you have to be really sensitive about taking things from other traditions and using them in your own. The dialogue of self-reflection. So when you do these things, there's some transformation in yourself. Inevitably, questions will arise, and you will have some sort of dialogue in yourself about, as a result of meeting this person, as a result of the questions they've asked me, what do I think about that? Is that going to change my faith at all? And what we have to remember is that our faith is constantly growing and changing. So change is not necessarily a bad thing. Or I guess it's a good thing if it's always happening, maybe. So just to recall that we are constantly in a conversion process. We are constantly returning to God, reorienting our lives, constantly interrogating, engaging with our faith. And so all these forms of dialogue help with that. So some essential attitudes for interfaith encounter. This is from an essay by Ruth Tetlow. Commitment to your own faith and to the search of truth. People want you to be committed to your faith. They don't want you to come in and say, well, you know, sometimes I like to do this and sometimes I like to do that. But if you're talking to a Muslim, they're going to want to say, no, I want to know, what does a Christian believe? Tell me what a Christian believes. And then you're going to say, well, some Christians believe this, and some Christians believe that. No, tell me what a Christian believes. And at the end of the day, it's important to remember that you and the people you're speaking with are only representing yourself. And you can try to represent what you think your religious body's official position is, but at the end of the day, you're speaking about yourself and your own experiences. And you're speaking from a place, hopefully, of conviction. It's okay to share doubts and whatnot, but commitment is a very valuable thing. Openness, being willing to listen and speak both sensitively and honestly. This stuff can get really tough as we talk about colonialism, as we talk about imperialism, as we talk about the Holocaust. There are very painful memories that have come from what we have done in the name of our faith traditions. And we have to be really, really sensitive, but not, and also not cover up the things that have hurt us. Being prepared to face the possibility that both you and the other may be changed by God. Like I said before, conversion is an endless process. And we hope that God will speak to us through all of our encounters. Archbishop Rowan Williams said in a sermon at the Church of Ireland General Synod in 2004, if we want to ask others to repent and search their past, we must do the same and try to understand how we are seen and why we are hated or feared. It is a challenge addressed to us all, and it is the hardest word that Christ can speak to us. We so long to be only the innocent victim. We so shrink from seeing that in different degrees we are all involved, both in receiving and in causing suffering. Being prepared to take risks, doing and seeing strange things, meeting strangers, not knowing how you will respond. A lot of people, the first time they go into a Hindu temple, it is a very, very alarming experience. A lot of Christians, that is, or people from monotheistic traditions. People who've been raised that you shall have no other gods before me, and idol worship is a bad thing, and these people are bowing down and kissing and offering things to stone statues. What is going on here? It can be a very, very alarming experience for people. It can be scary to meet these people with such foreign customs and beliefs. You have to take risks. You have to try to understand what's happening there. Why is this important to that person? You don't have to adopt that religious belief, but you have to recognize it's going to push you out of your comfort zone. Bearing in heart and mind the suffering of humanity and all creation as that is the context that you share with the other. People often come together around difficult issues. They're also pushed apart by difficult issues. Think about Israel-Palestine, right? We have to remember that when we feel hurt, there are others also feel hurt. And to recognize that is the context in which we're working. We're not the only ones who've been hurt. So, let's see. My formatting has gotten a little messed up on this projector, but this is a great resource, the Dialogue Decalogue, Ground Rules for Interreligious or Inter-Ideological Dialogue. And this is really helpful for whether you're talking to people of other faiths, whether you're talking to people of other political parties, a disagreement over how things should be run in the village. This is helpful. The first commandment. The primary purpose of dialogue is to learn, that is to change and grow in the perception and understanding of reality, and then to act accordingly. That's why we dialogue. Second commandment, interreligious or inter-ideological dialogue must be a two-sided project. It has to happen both within each religious or ideological community and also between religious and ideological communities. So like I said before, when you start talking to somebody of another faith, you then have to go back to your own faith and say, what's happening here? What's happening among us? Are there things we need to reform here? Are there things that I disagree with somebody else in my own faith about? Within and between. Third, each participant must come to the dialogue with complete honesty and sincerity. Mentioned that before. Makes sense. Fourth, in interreligious or inter-ideological dialogue, we must not compare our ideals with our partner's practice, but rather our ideals with our partner's ideals, our practice with our partner's practice. Really, 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 really. Fifth.
I have a good friend that always said, we judge ourselves by our intentions, we judge others by their actions.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah, that's the same kind of thing there.
Yeah. That's a good thing to think about when we read other people's scriptures, too. The Bible is very violent. The Bible has slavery. The Bible has a lot of horrible things in it, and we don't always talk about those, and we don't always think about those when we're thinking about other people's religions and the things we dislike in their scriptures. So just keep in mind, practice versus ideals. Fifth, each participant must define himself or herself. Conversely, the interpreted, the one who's being interpreted, must be able to recognize herself or himself in the interpretation. So try to represent people as they want to be represented, not as in the boxes that you want to put them in. Sixth, each participant must come to the dialogue with no hard and fast assumptions as to where the points of disagreement are. Trying to think of a good example about this. Like sometimes you think you know what the problem is. You think you know where you disagree, and you get there and you realize that the disagreement is actually really about something else. And it's only through having that conversation that you realize it's not X that you're actually like frustrated about. Really, it's Y. That's very abstract. But hopefully, as I talk through all these things, you can be thinking about personal examples from your own lives. Seven, dialogue can take place only between equals. Both must come to learn from each other. And that's really tricky here in the US, where Christians are clearly the majority. We have power, we have money. It's hard because it's automatically set up. If you throw an interfaith event, there will be more Christians than anybody else. And do you feel equal if you go to an event and you're the only one representing yourself there? I mean, just like if you're trying to be inclusive racially, you know, and, oh, well, there's the token black person, you know. There's our token Muslim at the interfaith event. So numbers makes this tricky, but recognizing treating others as equals, recognizing that you both have something to learn. Eight, dialogue can take place only on the basis of mutual trust. Nine, persons entering into interreligious, interideological dialogue must be at least minimally self-critical of both themselves and their own religious or ideological traditions. Ten, each participant eventually must attempt to experience the partner's religion or ideology from within. For a religion or ideology is not merely something of the head, but also of the spirit, heart, and whole being, individual and communal. So you don't have to change your beliefs, but you have to recognize that it's not just a cognitive thing. It's something you feel in your body. You can't just run down a list of, this is what I believe, hand somebody the Apostles' Creed. No, there's something more existential about it. Recognizing that that's the case for your partner in dialogue as well. So some interfaith organizations. I don't think we'll spend a lot of time there. But lots of really great groups doing stuff. I'm happy to give you this list if you're interested. So from those lists, that list, and many, many beyond that, there are many different kinds of interfaith activities. Chaplains have to deal with an interfaith setting. There are ad hoc groups. Have you heard of the book The Faith Club about these three women, a Christian, Muslim, and a Jew, who just get together and start talking about their faith? Congregationally based organizations. My mom works with a bunch of different congregations in downtown Minneapolis to end poverty and end homelessness. And so there are Muslim mosques, Jewish synagogues, and Christian churches that are all part of that. But it's congregationally based. Resource agencies with educational information and whatnot. Interfaith offices, agencies, dialogue groups. In Hyde Park, where I live, there's the Hyde Park Kenwood Interfaith Group, which has been around since like 1912 or something. They meet monthly to have a dialogue. Interfaith ministries, that's more and more like those interfaith ministers that I told you about who are very synchronistic. There are for-profit groups, media groups, national and international interfaith organizations like Religions for Peace, the World Parliament of Religions, local chapters of those, umbrella organizations, United Religious Initiative, religious leaders and clergy are involved, retreat or conference centers, social issue or action groups, so when people come together, like around ending homelessness, or something like this, and student or youth groups, like the Interfaith Youth Corps, based out of Chicago. This is what I find really fascinating. Some different approaches. Dialogue versus actions. Sometimes people just get together and they just talk about, well, what does salvation mean to you? What is creation for you? Sometimes people get together and they do stuff to try to make the world a more just, peaceful, and sustainable society. So how do you balance these things? In general, with all this, both and. Do both. It's helpful. Right-brained arts, heart, versus left-brain reason, head. The more you do across the spectrum, the better. Formal versus informal. Bi versus multilateral. Is it a Jewish-Muslim dialogue, or is it a Christian-Jewish-Hindu-Buddhist-Muslim dialogue? How many different faiths are you going to have involved? Do you have representatives or grassroots in your group? So, for example, do you have one Christian representing the Christians on your interfaith council? Or is it just anybody who wants to be on the council can be on the council, and then you're going to have a lot more Christians than anybody else? Those sorts of things. And that gets tricky when you say, well, there's a Mormon who wants to be part of our council. Are they included under the Christian representative? Or do they get their own representative? Well, they say that they're Christians. Some of the other Christians don't think they're Christians. What do we do if we have a Sunni and a Shiite Muslim? Do they both get to be representatives? They're both Muslim, but they're different. Organizational versus personal. Is there a grander organization? Or is it just on a person-to-person basis? This particularistic differentiated versus synchronistic or blended, is again, are we maintaining our religious differences, or are we coming together and saying, we all believe the same thing, we want love and peace, and I don't mean to mock that, I guess I've just had some bad experiences with that sometimes, and I find that it often alienates people who are really committed to their faith, so that there can be a stereotype of people who engage in interfaith things as wishy-washy or as not really committed to their faith. And I know so many people who are really deeply committed to their faith, and I think people who are really deeply committed to their faith should be having conversations with people of other faiths, because it strengthens your own faith. It helps you learn about others. So I'm definitely on this end of the spectrum there. Advocacy versus action versus conversation versus education. What's the goal of your dialogue? What are you trying to do together? And then this is really key to think about too. Luxury versus necessity. Are we coming together because we have to? Because if we don't, we're going to keep on killing each other? Or are we coming together because, well, it's just a nice thing to do? You know, we feel like this is something that would be healthy for our community. You know, it's a luxury for us to do this. Or are there real dire situations that are forcing us to this point? And in general, if you can build up some relationships before you hit a crisis point, before it becomes a necessity, that'll be a lot easier. So some practical tips. Thinking about etiquette, interreligious etiquette. There are lots of books out on this, like meeting the stranger, you know, what should you do in this situation, or in that if you go to a mosque, what should you wear, where should you sit, how should you address the person in charge of the mosque? Is it, are they a sheikh or an imam? You know, for a Muslim coming into a Christian church, well, is it a reverend, a priest, a pastor, a minister, a bishop? What are all these things? It's helpful to think about what is this person's title. If you don't know, ask them. Greetings. Some traditions, it might not be good to run up and give somebody a hug, especially if they're of the opposite sex. That would not be an appropriate greeting. Sometimes even handshakes with members of the opposite sex are not appropriate. So be careful with that. Good intentions don't always come out so well. Dietary needs. Be careful here. Muslims, no pork and halal meat, right? Jews, it needs to be kosher. Well, it depends on how orthodox they are. Hindus, you know, ask them, do they eat meat or not? And same with Buddhists. Roman Catholics, is it a Friday during Lent? Do we have to have fish? You know, different groups have different dietary needs. Don't throw an interfaith breakfast and serve sausage. calendars, again, be sensitive. What day is the holy day for people? If you're having an event on a Saturday, are Orthodox Jews going to be able to fully participate? Friday, what about Muslims? Think about maybe participating in each other's holy days or festivals. A lot of interfaith groups do things around three different holidays that are not really religiously affiliated. Martin Luther King Day, a lot of interfaith events that day. The International Day of Peace, September 21st, and Thanksgiving are times when interfaith groups tend to do a lot of stuff. Your planning team for an event. If you want it to be an interfaith event, have people from the different religions around the planning table. Don't just have Christians planning the interfaith event. If you want others to come, they need to have a stake in it. They need to have a role in planning it. But then thinking about who's representing you again. You know, like, have you gone and gotten the official highest ranking person, or is it, you know, there are all sorts of hierarchical norms about who should be the one that you're contacting, and you could really alienate some people if it seems like you're even unintentionally going around them to somebody else who's they're not their superior. So just be careful about who you're asking, who you're having represented on your planning team. Different communication styles. Some cultures are more straightforward than others. Some, there are all these formalities and this, you have to go through all this chit-chat before you get to the heart of the matter. You know, there are different, think about that, be sensitive to that. Be sensitive to humor. We try to lighten the atmosphere by telling jokes. Jokes can be very offensive. Think about the Danish cartoon controversy about the depiction of the prophet Muhammad. Not okay. So just be careful with starting out an interfaith event by saying a rabbi, a priest, and imam walk into a bar. You know, just be careful. in-house language. By that I mean there are a lot of things that we say as Christians that we know what it means. We know what grace means, right? We know what we say Jesus died for my sins means. Maybe we do. When we say the Trinity, when we say the Holy Spirit. But a Buddhist is not going to know what you mean by that. It'll spur you to greater reflection about what you mean by that. But just to recognize there are a lot of terms that we use that others aren't going to understand, and it goes the same way as well. Don't be afraid to ask questions. Just know your context, know what current events are going on, know that there's a conversation about a mosque at Ground Zero. Know what's happening. So some questions that I have about interfaith relations. There are some problems with the category of religion. How do you define what a religion is? How do you define the adjective religious? What would its contrast term be? Secular. Secular means partial or not whole, so then is religious something that's whole? If we think about the word religion, etymologically it comes from relinking or binding together, right? From the Latin religare. In Hindu, the word that we translate as religion is dharma, which means duty. Very different concept from what we say mean by religion. In Arabic, the word is deen, which means judgment or order or way of life. The concept of religion itself is really something that emerges in the Enlightenment period, in the colonial period, as we come into more and more contact with people of other religions. So my experience has mostly been in the Indian context, where Hinduism is so diverse. And we, well, the British, lumped it all together and said, this is Hinduism. It is a religion. But there are people within it who worship so many different gods. You know, it's hard to say any one constant about what Hinduism is. Is it fair to call it a single religion? People disagree about that. Then there's the issue of, you know, what constitutes a religion? Do you have to believe in God for it to be a religion? Well, Buddhism doesn't have a God. Is Buddhism a religion? And if we say Buddhism is not a religion, then is it somehow placed lower in our esteem because, oh, it's not a religion? You know, so they want to be respected, but, you know, they don't believe in God. But if we say that you don't need to have a God for it to be a religion, what about Marxism? What about football fans? You know, like, what is a religion? That's a question. It's a live, ongoing question. Differences within traditions may be greater than those across traditions. I have often found it's easier to, you know, get along maybe politically or socially with somebody from another tradition than a really conservative Christian. And I say, I feel like I have more in common with you, my Jewish friend, than I do with this other person who is a Christian. And I feel like that shouldn't be the case, but sometimes it feels that way, you know? And so recognizing that it's not that that the lines of demarcation do not always fall where we would expect them to fall. And so that as we talk with people of other traditions, we're going to have some really, really difficult conversations with people of our own religion. The boundaries of tradition, where does one tradition end and another begin? As I mentioned before, are Mormons Christians? With Hinduism, Jainism, Buddhism, sort of Eastern religions, oftentimes it can be hard to name exactly where one falls. Can one have multiple religious identities or practice multiple religions? I was at this interfaith academy, and there was a guy who said, I'm a Christian and a Buddhist. You know, well, what does that mean? And how does that affect an interfaith dialogue? Now, this person is trying to represent two traditions, or that's why, again, it's really important to meet that person as who they are. And they are talking from their experience. Ask them, how did they get to where they are? What about their tradition or their belief gives them joy, gives them energy, gives them life? Why do they believe what they believe? You know, what experiences have shaped them? It's about getting to know that person's story. And again, here we have more and more people who identify as spiritual but not religious. And so if you're having a fairly traditional conversation where, you know, well, you're a Christian, you're a Jew, you're a Muslim, what do we do with these people who say, no, I'm none of those. I don't identify with any of those, yet my faith is really important to me. So how do they participate in that conversation? And there's a lot of conversation going on right now about these multi-religious people or a great quote from a professor of mine. Is this sort of synchronistic approach the metaphysical equivalent of raiding one another's medicine cabinet? are people who take a little from this tradition and a little from that tradition ruthless seekers? Or are they trying to respect the great wisdom of all traditions? What does it mean that we're part of a culture where we can choose our religion? It's very different in other parts of the world. So to deal with some of those questions, I think the most important thing, or these are some good ways to get started with having a conversation. And so hopefully as you leave here tonight, I'm almost done, you can have some conversations with people around the village about these questions. When were you first aware of your religion? I am a Lutheran. When did that identity first strike you? You have a memory of that. When were you first aware that others had a religion different from yours? What was your earliest experience of the sacred? What was your first experience of significant engagement with someone of another religious tradition? Have you had an experience of religious discrimination? We don't think that happens so much to us as Christians, perhaps, but maybe as from a particular denomination, or increasingly in a more secular, hostile toward religion environment. Have you been discriminated against because you are a Christian, because you are a person of faith? How did that affect you? And talk about a person who was influential in helping you define yourself religiously. You know what? A person, a place, like Holden Village has shaped me so much to make me who I am and the faith that I have what it is. One last really awesome two slides, actually. This is just great. This is like that dialogue, decalogue thing. Thinking about the difference between dialogue and debate. Let this inform your whole way of being, of all your conversations. Dialogue. Listen with a view of wanting to understand. Debate. Listen with a view of countering what I hear. Dialogue. Listen for strength so as to affirm and learn. debate. Listen for weakness so as to discount or disvalue. Dialogue. Speak for myself from my own understanding and experiences. Debate. Speak based on my assumptions about others' positions and motives. Dialogue. I ask questions to increase understanding. Debate. I ask questions to trip up or to confuse. Dialogue. I allow others to complete their remarks. Debate. I interrupt or change the subject. Dialogue. I concentrate on others' words and feelings. Debate. I focus on the next point I want to make. Dialogue. I accept others' experiences as real and valid for them. Debate. I critique others' experiences as distorted or invalid. Dialogue. I allow for the expression of real feelings in myself and in others for understanding and catharsis. Transformation. Debate. I express my feelings in order to manipulate others or deny that their feelings are meaningful and legitimate. Dialogue, I honor silence. Debate, I use silence to gain advantage. Dialogue, I am respectful in time taken. I strive to be brief. And debate, I speak often and at length. Questions to ask yourself if you're having trouble staying in dialogue. Am I honoring my own experience? Can I trust others to respect my differences? Can I trust myself to be permeable yet maintain integrity? Am I willing to open myself to the pain of others and of myself? Am I able to live with tension? Lutherans are all about paradox. It's a good thing. Am I open to seeing God in others? Do I suspect others are forcing me to change? Do I fear that hearing other news will weaken my position? Am I denying pain I really have the strength to face? Am I viewing others as antagonists or as companions on a journey? So that's all I have for the evening. I want to encourage you to talk to other people about their faith, whether they're from other traditions or from your own, because we all have different beliefs and we can all learn and grow from one another. I've got a lot of resources here that I had meant to hold up and show you, but if you're interested, come up afterward, and please feel free to talk to me. The rest of the week we'll be moving on to some issues more specific to India. So thank you very much.
Thank you.